It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at Central Time, Milwaukee County hopes to eradicate chronic homelessness in the next 3 years with unique city-county collaboration. We'll talk to the head of that program.
First, Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled today to shut down the state's John Doe investigation into allegations of illegal coordination between Governor Walker's recall campaign and outside interest group like the Wisconsin Club for Growth. Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm had opened the secret investigation in 2012.
The decision was 4-2, with a majority arguing that the state's prohibition on coordination for a, quote, political purpose, unquote, is overly broad and unconstitutional. In delivering that decision, the court struck down that part of state campaign finance law. Here with us now to unpack this ruling is Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol reporter. Sean, good to have you back.
Hey, Rob.
So this ruling, justices were very clear on this point, shuts down the John Doe investigation. What was their argument for doing that?
Yeah, in fact, they used the words, to be clear, this conclusion ends the John Doe. The investigation is closed. And they basically said, as you mentioned in your introduction there, that the state law prohibiting coordination for a political purpose, that it is coordination between a campaign and an interest group, is too vague, and so they said it's unconstitutional. So the court said, thankfully, we have what it called a saving construction, and that is that you know, when you're an interest group, you just can't say vote for or vote against, and if you, as long as you abide by those rules, express advocacy rules, then you are basically free to do what you want. So then the court said, now that we know what the law is, it does not prohibit the kind of alleged conduct the Club for Growth or the Walker campaign was being investigated for as part of this John Doe. So then the court said, essentially, the special prosecutor in this Doe has no case, and the John Doe is closed.
So with a looser interpretation of that particular campaign coordination law, as advocated for by the dissent in this, looking at the behavior of the campaign and these outside groups, somebody might have said, yeah, this violated it. But under this stricter construction, as the majority said, it didn't violate the way they read that law.
Yeah, some of the the evidence that was unearthed this is a John Doe proceeding. So it's basically supposed to be secret. But we knew about a lot of it in part because the case was appealed through so many channels of the court system, the federal court and the state court. At one point, some of the documents that were supposed to be sealed were unveiled, and the prosecutor in this case had information that the Walker campaign was referring to the Club for Growth as your 501c4, basically encouraging people to donate money to groups like that because they can accept unlimited donations and keep those donations secret. So that's the type of behavior that investigators were saying and prosecutors were saying ran afoul of state law. What the court said today was that that state law is too broad, too vague, it's unconstitutional, and therefore that behavior does not violate the law.
In that ruling, did the Supreme Court, in effect, change a part of campaign finance law then in Wisconsin?
My understanding is that they did, that they changed an interpretation of campaign finance law that had been followed basically since 1976 and that had been upheld by a court ruling in Wisconsin in 1999. That's what the Government Accountability Board said. Francis Schmitz, who was the special prosecutor in this case, issued a statement. He said the decision represents a loss for the citizens of Wisconsin. He said it defies common sense that a Wisconsin resident of average means who gives $25 to a campaign has his or her name publicly reported under the law. But according to this decision, someone who gives, for example, $100,000 to a group which closely coordinates with the same campaign can remain anonymous.
And then the other side, the groups in particular that were part of this story said, this is political speech. This is free speech, donating, having these conversations, and we need to be very careful about anything that restricts that kind of speech. Is that the core of their side of the argument?
Their argument is that this decision, in the words of Republican Attorney General Brad Schimmel, quote, protects free speech for all Wisconsinites. So that was something that they said from the beginning of this case. whether it was at the federal court where they filed a lawsuit against the prosecutors in this case, alleging that they violated their constitutional rights, or in the state court system. It was always some variation of this is a First Amendment issue. But what we have here now is it is a change. I mean, the Supreme Court has changed how we're going to look at these issue advocacy groups, and they would have a lot more leeway now to coordinate with candidates and with campaigns than they've had before.
Talking to WPR state government reporter Sean Johnson about this morning's ruling from the state Supreme Court ending the John Doe investigation and Governor Walker's recall election campaign and outside groups involved with that. So, Sean, is this done now? This is it for state courts. Is there any thought that the prosecutors might try to take this on a federal court path now?
I guess they could. It seems unlikely. They could, for example, one of the grounds on which they could appeal is that prosecutors asked two of the justices on the court to recuse themselves from this case. And some documents that were made public for the first time back in May, Special Prosecutor Schmitz said that this case presented serious ethical issues because several of the people and groups being investigated also had significant involvement in the election of particular justices to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Said that recusal of two of the justices was clearly warranted. Those justices didn't even address that request in their decision here. So that's something that they could, that Prosecutor Schmitz could potentially appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, the highest court in the land. You know, the chances of that succeeding or even happening, I don't know. It seems unlikely. This was a state court issue, an issue involving a state law. It was decided in the state Supreme Court. That might be where it ends.
This was a 4-2 decision. There are seven justices. Complicated math tells me that one justice must have not voted here. It wasn't one of the ones that that the prosecutor had asked to recuse themselves.
We don't know specifically who the prosecutors asked to recuse themselves, but we know basically it was not Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, who was the justice who did recuse herself in the case. She stepped down or stepped aside in this case because of one of the attorneys working on the case, I believe is her son, if I remember that right. It was a personal relationship that she had that kept her from working on this case. So she stepped down on that basis. You didn't have any justices step down, though, in this case because they received significant financial help from the groups that were being investigated.
And finally, this happens, of course, the same week that Governor Walker officially kicked off his campaign for president. Is there a thought that the governor might say, here's another challenge from my opponents that I've overcome? Or is this just, okay, that chapter's over, they're looking forward now?
I think that's basically what he said in New Hampshire today, where he's campaigning, is that this is another time that the left tried to get me, and they failed. This is, people haven't been talking about the John Doe 2 a whole lot since it's been on hold in state court for some time. I mean, this challenge has been going on for a while now. So, that the investigation is closed now doesn't change a whole lot immediately. We do have all these documents that were released, whether they were supposed to be or not, that give some insight into the way the Walker campaign worked and the way it coordinated with groups and businesses. And we also have John Doe 1, which is part of the governor's record, where there were arrests of, you had six either former Walker aides or associates who were charged in that case. And so, I mean, that's a part of the governor's history. It's a part of his record. It's not one that has hurt him politically in Wisconsin, but he's obviously on a bigger stage now.
Sean, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
We've been talking to WPR State Capitol reporter Sean Johnson about the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruling today to shut down the John Doe investigation into alleged illegal coordination between Governor Walker's recall election campaign and outside political groups.
According to a 2014 study from the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, over 115 Milwaukee people may be homeless on any particular day, and over half of them chronically so. But experts believe the real number of chronically homeless may actually be higher.
An ambitious new program from the Milwaukee County Housing Division aims to stamp out chronic homelessness within 3 years. Based on the Housing First model that's been used in other parts of the country, the program hopes to serve about 300 people every year.
The administrator of the Milwaukee County Housing Division, James Matthew, joins us now. James, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's start out by getting the basics. Can you give us an outline of the plan?
Sure. So what you mentioned earlier, we looked at our point-in-time data, which is really a group of nonprofits, government individuals, and volunteers, which literally counts the homeless individuals in Milwaukee County. Those would be individuals sleeping on the street, but also in our homeless shelters. And what our point-in-time survey found in 2014 was about 195 chronically homeless individuals. So what our plan is trying to do is not only house those individuals using the Housing First philosophy, but a lot of us know that that's an under-reporting. So our plan is really to try to serve 300 people, knowing that there is more than 195.
Well, let's talk about what Housing First means, because in many cases in the past, the homeless person might qualify for that housing by going through various treatment steps, but this is taking a different approach. How?
Yeah, what this really is kind of a barrier-free model. So it sounds simplistic, but the goal of Housing First is really to get somebody into permanent housing immediately. So Housing First isn't based on where you're at with treatment, where you're at with medical appointments, where you are with your criminal background. Our goal is really to get you into housing immediately, and then we wrap supportive services around you, whether that be mental health treatment, alcohol and drug treatment, representation through court processes, whatever that happens to be. But our goal is really to take an individual directly off the street and immediately put them into their own permanent housing.
Now, as I understand it, this was pioneered by a guy named Dr. Sam Samberis. So where else has this model been tried, and how has it worked?
So there's been, as you mentioned, Dr. Sam Samberis was the originator of this plan in New York. We actually flew in Dr. Samberis to meet with the downtown businesses to go over this plan, as well as specifically what we can do in downtown Milwaukee. So he's had great success in New York. There's also been a lot of talk lately about Utah. Utah has been very successful in eliminating chronic homelessness, and I know Dr. Samberis is also in Canada, and the nation of Canada is actually looking at adopting a Housing First initiative because the data definitely shows that individuals can be placed into housing with pretty severe needs, and then also the public wins because we see a dramatic decrease in emergency room visits, police time, detox time, and fairly expensive social services.
What do we know about why it seems to work to get people into housing first and foremost, and then, as you said, sort of wrap the treatment around that core? Why does that work?
Well, we've already noticed the change locally because we got some funding to begin this July 1st. So our housing division now has its own outreach team, homeless outreach team, which we've never had before. And we're encountering individuals. There were two individuals that we're looking at. They're actually apartment shopping right now that have been homeless in the city of Milwaukee on the streets for 5 years and 4.5 years. And they have never been successfully housed. And as they have told my staff, it's always in the past been barriers to them accepting housing, whether they weren't quite ready with alcohol and drug treatment, or they didn't quite get the services they received. And a lot of the services that folks offered them in the past, they weren't interested in, and it became a major barrier to their housing. So now with the Housing First philosophy, our team can talk to these individuals, and it's really about meeting their basic needs and putting somebody directly into housing. And we're finding that folks are much more interested in that than the way that housing has been done in the past in Milwaukee.
We're talking right now with James Matthew, administrator of the Milwaukee County Housing Division, talking about a new program coming to Milwaukee called Housing First, which aims to put a sizable dent in the homelessness issue in Milwaukee. And what sort of housing is this? What does it look like, and where is it?
Sure. So a vast majority of the housing is scattered site housing, which means we're going to work with existing landlords that we already work with, as well as potentially new landlords, where an individual coming into our program, receiving housing first, actually gets to choose the area of town that they're familiar with. They can kind of choose their style of apartment. So really it's trying to get individuals interested in driving their own housing, driving their own treatment, and having as much say as they can. So the great thing I think about the plan that we have is we're not necessarily waiting on new subsidy or new construction or a lot of rehabilitation of buildings. We're able to start right away because we're using existing resources. The only new construction that we're doing, there's a project that received low-income housing tax credits through WEDA. That'll be a 24-unit apartment building for those that are chronically homeless but also have very serious alcohol addictions. So that's going to be one of the new construction models that will be a part of this. But all the other units are just existing housing throughout Milwaukee County.
Now, as you said, you're trying to target the chronically homeless and get them in homes. How do you find these people, and how do you determine whether or not they qualify?
Sure. So the definition of chronic homelessness is an individual who's been homeless for a year straight or has four distinct episodes of homelessness within 3 years. The individuals that are homeless, that are in our existing homeless shelters, are easier to find because our database shows kind of exactly where these individuals are, what shelters they're in, and how many folks there are. So those are the easy individuals to find, and we have two existing case management agencies that just began doing this work to house those individuals right now. The individuals that are harder are obviously individuals that are sleeping literally on the streets, in parks, under bridges, wherever it happens to be throughout Milwaukee County. And that's where it takes our homeless outreach workers some time. And they literally go out every single day through the Milwaukee County Housing Division and a few of our nonprofit partners, and we're out every day trying to find individuals, either kind of through hotspots that workers got to know or through contacts with the Milwaukee Police Department that have noticed homeless camps or individuals sleeping on the street. So those individuals are a little harder to reach, but we're pretty confident that we'll find them.
Have you got some of these people in homes already?
Well, we've identified between 20 and 25 individuals already. Again, we just started our first batch of funding July 1st, but our outreach team has been working since then. I gave the two examples of the gentlemen that have been homeless for 4.5 or 5 years straight. We probably have half of those individuals that we've already seen that are very interested in housing first. And then we are working with shelter agencies because they already have the individuals that are chronically homeless in the shelters. So they'll be able to refer. Right now, actually, we have the rental subsidy in place, and we also have five different total case management contracts. So we're accepting referrals right now.
And how would you say that this affects the life of a homeless person? Since shelter is at the top of the list of needs that people have on a day-to-day basis, what does this change for people?
Well, I think it's a complete quality of life change for individuals. It really tries to reach individuals that just have not had access to their basic needs. So through our Housing First initiative, they'll have their own apartment of their choosing. We'll be able to furnish those apartments with pots and pans and linens and furniture and everything. And really it's meeting an individual's basic needs without coming at somebody talking about what issues they're having in treatment and court and different things that the community thinks they need. It's really a client-centered approach where we're finally asking individuals what their wants and needs are, and housing's always the top of that list.
Now, one other thing you're doing in conjunction with this is you're meeting with business owners and people involved in the downtown business scene in Milwaukee, and you're urging them not to call the police, but to call you instead. How will that work?
Yes, we had an event with the Milwaukee Downtown Business District a couple weeks ago where we had Dr. Sam Sanberis, the originator of Housing First, flying from New York, and kind of work with us to talk about downtown businesses. There's been a lot of attention in downtown with increased panhandling and homeless issues and behavioral issues that business owners are concerned about. So we do have a plan in conjunction with our Housing First plan that we think would really serve the downtown Milwaukee area well. What we're proposing is to take a community prosecutor, which is an individual. It's more of a community liaison through the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office that would just work with citizens and businesses downtown. And if they find individuals that clearly need housing or mental health treatment, those individuals would be served by the housing division. And if they're individuals that do not meet any of that criteria and are kind of creating nuisance-type behaviors, those individuals can be held accountable in the criminal justice system. So that's one part of it. The other part would be an additional homeless outreach worker on our housing division team that would be located just in the downtown business district. We think we can find an awful lot of individuals that will be eligible for our Housing First plan. And then the third thing is the opening of a new homeless resource center. I mentioned the 24-unit apartment building that's being constructed by Cardinal Capital Management. Within that 24-unit apartment building, we're going to have a homeless resource center, and we're looking for some extra funding for individuals to get referrals for mental health treatment, referrals for jobs, education, and to kind of give them a home base to get those resources. So that's what we're proposing to the downtown business district. We think it would have a very large impact.
James, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That was James Matthey, administrator of the Milwaukee County Housing Division. Cities and towns across Wisconsin share a number of questions and challenges. How to maintain a vibrant downtown, how to keep younger people from moving away, how to provide modern-day services without giving up a unique historical identity.
We've heard these questions come up from Wausau to Waukesha, from Columbus to Milwaukee. A lot of it boils down to this. What's unique about our community? How can we build on that? How can we share that with the world? Our next guest has been working with communities on these issues for years. Andy Lewis joins us now. He's a professor and a community development specialist, now retired as of Monday, at the UW Extension Center for Community and Economic Development. Andy, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you've worked with communities around the state and some around the country. How common are these issues for communities to be developed, to be dealing with?
Well, it's very common, and I think it's actually one of the starting points for communities that want to improve themselves. I mean, it's not a matter of whether communities want to change, it's whether they want to guide that change, right? And most communities are interested in guiding that in a positive way, and this is a good place to start. What are they known for?
And this is something that communities have the power to do something about, because you mentioned a change will happen whether you want it or not. Communities actually have power to do something about this.
Absolutely, and you know, when you talk about things that a community are famous for, there are certainly communities that start off with a negative image, and that's much more challenging to try to overcome that than starting from scratch and really having a non-identity. But there are certainly examples of communities that have even reversed very negative images into a positive one.
Like, what can you give an example or two?
Yeah, I mean, I hate to even pick on them, but because it's a positive story, I think about when I moved down to Grant County, Wisconsin, in southwesternmost county, right across the river in Dubuque. Even in the 1980s, they were burning crosses in Dubuque. And I remember just thinking, how could that possibly be happening in a city like Dubuque? And Dubuque didn't have a positive image, kind of a rundown industrial town, but Dubuque is now being held up as one of the poster childs for how a community can turn itself around and kind of regenerated interest in its location on the river with the River Museum and downtown revitalization. And it's a fabulous community to visit today. But I could, you know, you could talk about Cleveland, you could talk about a number of other communities that had a less than positive image.
Well, let's start with a community that maybe doesn't have much of an identity, much less a negative one. How do you start figuring out, hey, what is unique about us? What is our selling point?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things that have to be in place, and I couldn't help but mention leadership. You have to have leadership within the community that sees this as a priority and that wants to get the community engaged in making that decision. And by that, I don't necessarily mean elected officials. You know, that could be the leadership within a chamber of commerce or a Main Street organization or a civic organization or even just a collection of people in their community that want to do something positive. But it certainly helps if you have the elected officials on board and it becomes kind of your official slogan or your official identity that you're working on. And then you have to have a process in place. You have to have a process to help determine what it is that you're trying to do and the image that you're trying to portray. And there are some tools to help with that that I spend a few minutes talking about. I mentioned to you just at the start of the program that one of the programs I developed, it's almost been 25 years now, with a colleague down in Gotham, Wisconsin, James Schneider, who was the economic development director in Grant County at the time. We developed a program called First Impressions. And First Impressions was a community that paired up two similar communities, and we applied the secret shopper concept. The community sent a team of volunteers in to visit the community, and we essentially gave them a cookbook or a checklist of the things to check out in the community and then reflect back on that. So the comments and the pictures that they take are in a final report, and the community gets a good summary of how outside visitors might view their community as a place to visit, a place to live, or a place to do business. And that's been a very effective program. It hasn't gone away. And we did the first exchange in 1991 in between Fenimore and Bellevue, Iowa. And that's now been used by over 600 communities in Canada and the U.S. So that's a fun, simple way to maybe get started and not just do navel gazing with a bunch of residents sitting around a table thinking about, you know, what it is that they do well. Because if they're trying to appeal to outsiders, that's a great program to use to get at that.
Now, suppose you've got that initial leadership, whoever it is that wants to do this, that wants to maybe take that first step. I imagine this can't just be a top-down process. Who needs to be at the table? What stakeholders need to be involved to get buy-in to make something like this actually take fire and actually work?
Yeah, I think effective communities find ways to engage broad section of the community, and it's not easy to do that. I mean, there are communities where a select number of people seem to make a lot of the decisions, but I think the most effective communities find a way to get people engaged. And it, you know, not surprisingly, I think that starts with education. You have a lot of uninformed people in the community that really don't know what's going on at the city council meetings or the chamber of commerce meetings. So you start with education, and then slowly you work them into being participants, and then hopefully some of those participants become leaders in the community and want to play a role.
Well, that's amazing. I mean, it seems like apathy is your biggest enemy, and not in a negative way. People have lives. They're worried about their house, their job, their kids, and things like that. How do you get more of those people to say, all right, I want to step up and be part of this process that's going to be boring or contentious from time to time, but it's worth it in the long run?
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the reasons why a program like First Impressions was popular, because it is fun. I mean, who doesn't like to play a visitor for the day? Who doesn't like to go visit communities and not only learn about the strengths and weaknesses in their communities, but learn from another similar community, see what other communities are doing right and wrong. But there's passionate people in every community, but it takes somebody to organize that and to get people around the table and starting a process. And so I just mentioned First Impressions, but the Center for Community and Economic Development, where I worked for about half of my 32 years, has developed a number of tools. The Community Economic Development Preparedness Index is another one that steps communities through a number of factors that influence the local economy. Downtown retreats. Bill Ryan, one of my longtime colleagues, is kind of known as the downtown guru in Wisconsin and is very knowledgeable about the issues within Main Street, has developed a whole toolbox to help develop our Main Street areas. Just doing listening sessions or a technique like snow carding, which is just jotting down ideas on index cards and organizing them around themes. There are a number of things that you can do as part of that community development process to get people engaged and to build some kind of consensus.
Talking to Andy Lewis, longtime community development specialist here in Wisconsin, about what communities can do to figure out what their identity is and then use that identity to bring in business, get young people to stay, get other good things out of their city or their town. So it sounds like there's a lot of tools there so they don't have to reinvent the wheel. When people go through the kind of processes you're talking about, what are some of the identities you've seen towns and cities adopt? I could think of a lot, you know, charming art community or bustling downtown or mm-hmm. great place to live and commute from. What's the range of things people come up with?
Yeah, well, I had a a colleague who's also now retired, Dave Mensch. And Dave Mensch, back in 1989, did a report on community slogans to try to figure out, well, what were communities using for an identity in Wisconsin? And then, equally important, did that have any economic benefits, or what were the benefits of having a slogan? And actually, you can still find most of those communities listed in a Wikipedia listing. So if you're interested in that, go online, do a search on Wikipedia by Wisconsin community nicknames. And about 80% of the citations are from Dave's study going back to 1989. When I look at Wisconsin, I think, not surprisingly, a lot of communities have capitalized on natural amenities, their proximity to a national forest or a wild river, or some kind of a hobby like turkey hunting capital of Wisconsin. There's two communities, I think, that claim that. Boscobel's one. And you have actually a number of the communities that have the same slogan. So that, you know, doing some homework, things like the Wikipedia search, would help you maybe not pick an identity that somebody else has and try to come up with something that's unique.
So once you have that identity, how do you harness that? How do you let other people know about it in such a way that gets them to do what you want, come in and tour, or spend money in your town, maybe move there?
Yeah, I think there's some good news, and I wanted to make sure I put in this plug that Christine Runge has been hired by the Center for Community and Economic Development. She's actually a community marketing specialist that you'd probably want to have on the show after she starts in August. But she's going to help communities figure that out. I mean, what do you do with that unique resource that you have in the community, and how do you get some social or economic benefits out of that? But I'd argue that some kind of an identity, whether that's slogan or just some kind of infrastructure that you're known for, you start to build that into your signage. You start to build it into festivals or a community event. You certainly build that into your promotion and advertising and communications with the media. And when Dave did his study of slogans, what he found is by having that identity, it really had an impact in four areas. It helped build an identity. People want to be known for something, right? When you explain where are you from and you tell them the community, it's nice to be able to say, well, we're known for this or that. I think that that's important. He talked about the impact that it has on community pride, that when people are proud of the community that they're from, they're more likely to get involved in some of the things that we were just talking about. That's how you get people passionate about their community and willing to volunteer some time to improve it. It also has an impact on perhaps community services or just building community. And then lastly, the economic benefit. I mean, we have a wealth of huge community festivals in this state that have large economic benefits.
We're talking to UW Extension Community Development Specialist Andy Lewis, looking at ways Wisconsin cities and towns can build a unique identity and then use that identity to maybe promote tourism, keep and attract residents, and make more vibrant downtown areas.
And you can join the conversation. What makes your community unique? What is your city or your town doing to build on that? Or what does it still need to do, do you think? What is your downtown like today? Is it vibrant, active, charming? Or is it run down, overlooked, maybe somewhere in between? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with Andy Lewis, Community Development Specialist at the UW Extension Center for Community and Economic Development. We're looking at ways to build a unique community identity and how Wisconsin towns and cities can use that identity to promote downtown areas and keep younger people from moving away.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What's the story in your community? What makes your town or your city unique? Is it history, parks, waterfronts, stores, art, you name it? What could be done to promote that more? If you're younger, what would get you to stay in or leave your hometown? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Andy, arts. A lot of towns have gone that way as a something, or arts and culture, I should say, to promote their identity. Eau Claire has done a lot of this. Their big music festival, their inaugural music festival, kicks off pretty soon. Is that a common direction that we see a lot of communities going in?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when you think about it, most communities have obviously more than one asset. And so it can be a little bit of a challenge deciding, well, what is it that you actually want to be famous for? What are you going to use for your marketing approach? And as I was thinking about this show, I was actually thinking about my father who worked on the state recreation plan back in the 1960s. And they used a really interesting process to try to identify the parcels that they should prioritize for purchase for public lands. And they had community meetings all across the state, and they developed a series of icons. The icons were done by Bruce Murray, now retired landscape architect. He actually lives a few blocks from me. And those icons fell into a number of categories: cultural, historical, natural, man-made. That process would be really relevant today to do the same thing, or maybe even just do a checkup on that 1960 study and see how many of those resources are still around. But by taking an asset-based approach and actually taking the time to inventory what you have in the community, I think that's how you get at what's unique about your community.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Jamie on the line in Boscobel. Jamie, hi.
Hi. Hi, Andy. It's Jamie. How are you?
I recognize that voice. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, I promise I'll get that video of your father to you.
Yeah.
Hey, the reason why I'm calling is that Boscobel used to be the birthplace of the Gideon Bible, and then they adopted that, wild turkey hunting capital. What do you think about communities that try to capitalize on two different mottos?
You know, Jamie, I don't see any reason why you can't do both. And in Dave's study, he actually mentions both of those for Boscobel. And maybe the way you most effectively do that is if you have different organizations taking the lead. So if there's one big turkey hunting is seasonal. You've got the spring season and the fall season. So what do you do the rest of the year? And so that's the Gideon Bible. So I think communities have limited resources, and for that reason, many communities choose one. But I don't see any reason why, multiple events or multiple things that you're known for would be problematic. And just find different organizations within the community to take the lead role.
Jamie, thanks for your call. Talking to Andy Lewis about community identities in Wisconsin. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. What makes your town, your city, your area unique? What do people think of when they think of it? Or what should we think of when we hear the name of your town? 800-642-1234. Andy, we hear a lot about brain drain at different levels in the state. Young people grow up, they move somewhere else to get a job, somewhere else that matches their lifestyle needs. What are communities doing to try to turn the tide on that?
Well, I tell this story a number of times. So when I first moved to Lancaster, Al Weber was the mayor there, and he was one of the first people to come into my office. And Al used to get really frustrated with the community that talked about brain drain, that the best and brightest were leaving the community. And he always argued that we ought to encourage our youth to explore the world, and what we ought to focus on is building communities where people will want to come back to. So if the community ignored the needs of the youth, they're never coming back. They would never consider coming back to raise a family or to start a business or to retire in that community. But if their needs were taken care of as a youth, that would be much more likely to happen. But there has been, I think, a resurgence of interest in attracting young, urban, highly educated professionals, for example. I've seen that interest in a number of communities. And the biggest reason is that Wisconsin lags behind in that many of our communities are probably seen as not being desirable to that group. But, you know, as I go through and I think about the things that are attractive to that demographic, I find myself thinking, well, I'm interested in that as an old fart. You know, I like having live music and the arts and places to meet. And, you know, we're not young forever either. That's the other thing. So the things that are important to the young urban professionals are going to be different in 20 years. So we really need to have communities that are appealing to all demographics. But certainly those issues can create conflict in a community, and it's important to manage that. And again, at least give people the opportunity to participate in the process. But at the end of the day, communities have to do well at attracting and retaining all demographics.
Yeah, I've heard of that conflict you mentioned where if you're trying to provide those services for the young people, the amenities that bring them in, are you losing the unique character, the traditions of that town at the same time? Can you have both, or is there necessarily a conflict there?
There are certainly communities that go through transitions. And I remember when I was in college, reading LeMaster's Blue Collar Aristocrats, which talked about the community where I live today, which is Middleton. And that book was, the research was done in a tavern, and it was actually a best-selling academic book, but it talked about the transition from Middleton going from a blue-collar community to a white-collar community. So those changes do take place. It does create tension. But, I would argue that, no, a community should never lose what contributes to the quality of life. So those historic elements of the community, the cultural, the things that were part of their history, I think those things should always be preserved. But I think we also need to be cognizant and aware of what some groups require. And it may be something more than that. And maybe those things may be less important to them.
Time for a quick call. Patrick in Eau Claire. Patrick, hi. Briefly, what did you want to bring up?
Oh, you know, one of the things that really attracts younger professionals like myself to places like Eau Claire, where I've been living for 1 year, is waterfront dining. And in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, we have two rivers that meet, but zero waterfront dining. So I'd like to get your thoughts on maybe some other communities that have done waterfront dining as part of their economic development strategies.
Patrick, thanks a lot. Briefly, take advantage of that waterfront if you can.
Andrew. Yeah, Patrick, that's a great point, and it's amazing how many communities are located in proximity to natural resources like that and don't take full advantage of that. So while I'm talking about Madison, I think you could be somewhat critical of Madison of not having a number of spots. But if you look at Madison and the redevelopment of the Edgewater, for example, the Edgewater Hotel and Restaurant, phenomenal place to see a view. The building of the Monona Terrace finally provided a public access point for the lakes and the rivers. But there are a lot of communities that have the same problem that you have in Eau Claire, that for some reason they don't recognize the value of that natural amenity.
Andy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's former professor, just retired professor Andrew Lewis, community development specialist, talking about community identity in Wisconsin. Keep it going on the Central Time Facebook page.